Hi, and welcome to The Thing About Cotton, a podcast brought to you by the International Cotton Association. We are your hosts, Camille Cluzel and Katie Farron, members of the ICA's Women in Cotton Committee. Join us as we explore the anatomy of the cotton value chain and bring awareness to the industry through highlighting female leaders and their achievements. As we've mentioned in our previous episodes, the cotton value chain touches pretty much all parts of the world. Farmers produce cotton in the US, Australia, Brazil, India, West Africa, China, and more places. Textile mills, primarily in Asia, the subcontinent, and Turkey, spin cotton and other materials into yarn. And that yarn is then spun into fabrics, garments, textile, and medical products that consumers use daily. Great, in theory, that seems pretty seamless, but how does this work in practice? Who sets the price for cotton, and how do farmers, mills, and end users know when to buy, when to sell, and how to connect with each other? Well, that's where the cotton futures market comes into play. Over the next couple of episodes, we will be discussing the role that both the Intercontinental Exchange, or ICE, futures and the cotton merchants play, from the liquidity that they provide to the risk they mitigate and so on.
This week, we are so excited to welcome a powerhouse in the industry who has had a very diverse and impressive career in commodities over the last 20 plus years. Jennifer Ilkew started her career out of university working in auto insurance for the Canadian government. After a few years and a short backpacking stint around Southeast Asia, Jennifer decided she wanted to live the expat life and orchestrated a master plan to move to Singapore and develop her career there. After completing her MBA at the University of Toronto, including an exchange program in Singapore, Jen moved to Singapore, where she remained for over two decades. Jen began her career here with groundbreaking work at the Monetary Authority of Singapore, or MAS, where she worked with the Singapore Exchange to develop an OTC commodity derivatives clearing facility with over 140 institutions signed on, and encouraged 10 international banks to set up regional commodity derivatives trading desks in Singapore. After 2 years with MAS, Jen moved to the New York Mercantile Exchange, or NYMEX, where she opened their Singapore office and transformed it into the firm's APAC headquarters. In 2007, Jen transitioned from the NYMEX to ICE as the director of Asia Pacific. Throughout her time at ICE, she has had vast marketing, sales, and business development experience, not the least of which was helping ICE acquire the Singapore Mercantile Exchange and developed and rebrand ICE Futures Singapore as the preferred clearinghouse for traders in Singapore. After 15 years with ICE Singapore, she moved to New York to take on the role as president of ICE Futures US in 2022. Throughout her career, Jen has had an impact on shaping Singapore as the commodities trading hub in Southeast Asia, as well as developing several clearinghouses in this market. Jen's career is a testament to taking risks, seizing opportunities, and above all, being incredibly savvy about it all. It is an honor for us to have Jen on the podcast and discuss with her not only her career progression, but also about the role that ICE Futures plays within the cotton value chain.
Hi, Jen. Hi. It's a huge pleasure to have you join us today on the podcast. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, Camille. Hey, Katie. Thank you so much. And that's a lovely intro. It was amazing to hear all of that. I don't think I've ever put it together that way.
It does have a different ring when somebody else says it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was very flattering. Thank you.
It wasn't hard. You've had a very impressive career.
Thank you very much. It's great. There's been so much excitement about all the different things I've been able to achieve, but also how it all links together in ways that when you look back on it, you see it. You don't see it as you're going through it, but certainly when you look back and so you put it all together, it's exciting. It's exciting. And there's hopefully a lot more to come.
It's wonderful for us, you know, to have a strong female leader in the industry to look up to, like we have in you. Thank you again for joining us today. Where in the world are we finding you today?
Today, I'm in London. So I spent the last week in our London office, mostly with internal colleagues trying to sort of make sure I keep these relationships open, dig into parts of the business and have some fun as well. We had our Ice Golf Day, which we do every July 4th for the commodity space. So that was really quite fun as well. And we've got a rainy day here in London. So I was hoping to go do some window shopping, but I think it's going to be more work for the rest of the day.
So tournament, golf tournament, is there more female representation in golf, cotton, or oil?
We had one from sugar and one from oil. None from cotton yet. So Camille, we're going to have to get you to come out golfing. And I'm solely trying to build and see how many people. I've realized it can't just be London female golfers. It's got to be London and around. So you are on my list for next year, as well as I have found there's somebody in sugar in Antwerp. I think she's like a six golfer. So she's quite good. So yeah, so I think we might have to put her on a different team. I'm certainly not that good, but we will figure it out. But I think I'm starting to find more women, at least in Europe, that we can start bringing in for this golf day. Yeah, it's quite lovely.
So now your current role, president of ICE Future US, how has your role shifted from your previous position? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so probably the biggest shift for me is I had for years and all the ICE and even with my NYMEX days and actually even with the MAS days, it was largely sales. So it was going out and really trying to get people to come in and use your product. So that was whether actually it's along all the side at MAS, it was trying to get people to come into Singapore and use Singapore as their basis for trading. And then when it was NYMEX and ICE, it was trying to get people to trade more on NYMEX and ICE. And this role is much different. You are, all of a sudden, you're not a salesperson. It is a lot of work with the regulators, a lot of work with different internal clients as well, or work clients to people internally, whether it's a clearinghouse or other parts of our business. And it's a shift. The moving away from sales is a shift, because often I now can see the side where when I was in sales, I was pushing senior management to do things that I wanted. Now I'm getting a whole different, bigger perspective of, I'm going to say no to things because of this, or I'm going to say no because of the costs involved. And when you're in sales, you just want to sell, and you're not looking at all the different levels behind it and where the costs would be. So it has been a fantastic eye-opening experience, and also working with the salespeople, because I think it took them a while also to, it's a different move. So they're used to talking to you in sales, and now they're talking to you in a different role as head of the exchange. And how do you work through that with your colleagues? And it's taken a while, but it feels like it's coming as well.
When you moved from Asia to US, did you shift the markets you were working with at all? I know you mentioned you were mostly working in sales with oil when you were here in Singapore, right?
Yep. Yeah, so Singapore was much more predominantly oil. We had, when we split up our product base, we did look at the ICE Futures Europe and the ICE Futures US soft products, so the coffee, sugar, cocoa, a little bit of cotton. But there wasn't a huge amount of trading where we would have clients that we were trying to pull in. We were trying to get more retail clients to trade in Asia. And at one point, we had launched the World Cotton Contract. And at that time, we were trying to see, could we have cotton delivered into Asia? So that was working with the Malaysian government and the Malaysian Port Authority to figure out how to use their ports for a physical delivery into Asia and how to get inspection done and those pieces. But it really, I probably say it was about 5 to 10% of my time. And the other 90% sort of varied from energy products to environmental products to crypto. So it just depended on the time frame. But it was really, so this is a shift. And when I've come over to these products, and ICE Futures US covers all the softs, as I've mentioned. So we're the biggest market for coffee, sugar, cotton, orange juice, canola. And then you look at our equity derivative contracts, because we have MSCI, which is our franchise. MSCI, Emerging Markets, and EFAR are the two biggest equity derivatives we have. We have gas and power through the U.S., and then we have a number of environmental climate contracts as well. So it's definitely a slightly different scope. And the softs now, for me, and everything in cotton, for example, is trying to understand much more about the intricacies of the contract, how the rules work, how delivery works, how the different stakeholders interact within the U.S., outside of the U.S. as well. So, and it's fascinating to see much more of the inner workings, whereas when you're a salesperson, and certainly in Asia, because you do a broad piece of sales, you don't get into the details as much, where this is quite exciting because you start looking at the details. And I'm working with merchants and traders and the regulators and all these different pieces and putting it all together. And it's fascinating to see also how they interact. So we see that cotton is looking closer more at the environmental contracts and how it impacts the environment and how carbon sequestration from the ground, how they can basically pull carbon out of the environment with cotton. So it's interesting.
Talking about the ags market, etc., can you talk about specifically, just to start from basics, what is the ICE Futures Exchange and what is in general a clearinghouse and the role of a clearinghouse?
Okay. Yes. So the exchange is just a platform where people come to trade and find out the prices for different products. So we'll use cotton because that's probably the easiest one. And when it's a physical commodity, it's much easier to understand. So we have a trading platform and firms will come or people, individuals will come and say, what is the price of cotton on ICE Futures US? And they will often base their cotton trading, depending on what they do, on that price. My boss, he had told me once that he had met farmers in Mongolia who they get on their telephone, they download their mobile, and they figure out the price of cotton in the US to determine how they are going to price cotton in Mongolia. So with all that, so it really ends up being a global product where people say, okay, the price is here and our product may be a little bit better or worse and we might add a little bit of price, but this is where we're going to base our price on. We're going to say it's X cents per pound. How much are we going to increase it by? How much are we going to decrease it by? We have a number of players that go in and they use different risk management tools and they wanted to manage their price of cotton. So they might want to say, I understand that the price of cotton is going to be about 80 cents. I want to make sure I know exactly what I'm going to be getting over the next year and a half. And they use our futures contracts as a way to kind of streamline the prices they're going to get. It makes them more comfortable because rather than having a volatility in cotton prices, and sometimes you're getting 82 cents, sometimes you might be getting 70 cents, you just know I'm going to get 80 cents. And then you're able to figure out your inputs based on what your output's going to be and what you're going to sell that as. Part of it is to get as many people on the platform as possible to be able to trade. Because the more people you have, the more liquidity you have. We call it the tighter the bid and ask. So on the platform, you'll see buying prices and selling prices. And the tighter those are and the closer they are together, the more valuable it is for somebody who wants to buy and sell. Because if you have a big spread between what you're going to buy and what you're going to sell it, you can lose more money. And also when the bid and ask is very wide, often you have less players in the market. And while some people may say it's great to have maybe only cotton traders in the market and you shouldn't have players that are looking at pricing cotton even though they don't have the physical access to the market, or they might be hedge funds, or there might be speculators, or there might be the retail in there. Having them in there actually tightens the bid and ask and makes it easier for clients and people who wanted to manage the risk to get in and out of the contract. So our goal is really to get as many people on there as possible. And it's quite fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, ICE, of course, deals with more of the derivative side of the market. And as you mentioned, you know, managing risk for those who use the platform. But ICE must be intertwined as well with the physical side, especially because there's the physical delivery of cotton within
That's
the contract.
Yeah.
So how does ICE stay
relevant, I guess, connected
to the physical side of the market?
Yeah, so, and that's a really good question, and you're absolutely right. So not all of our contracts are physically delivered, and we have a number of oil contracts that are cash settled, but really our predominant soft, so coffee, sugar, cotton, orange juice, canola, sugar, did I name them all? They are physically delivered. So on the cotton side, we have a number of rules where we go through, this is what the cotton has to be when it comes in. This is how it's got to be graded. We have inspectors that go and look at the cotton, make sure it meets the requirements before it gets delivered onto the end user. It's all about how it gets on to a different delivery platform and then gets delivered to the person who's buying it or who's selling it. And a lot of the interaction ends up being with the merchants, with the traders, with anybody who's linked to the regulators. So for example, we work very closely with the American Cotton Shippers Association in the US, and they give us a lot of feedback on this is useful, but this isn't. And we also have committees. So all of our softs have committees. So we have the Cotton Committee, which we meet, I think it's four times a year. And we'll go through and we'll say, okay, what's going on in the market now? What is the issue we have in the market? Sit there and say, okay, we have this issue in the market. How are we going to respond to it? The interesting thing about the committee is it's made up of players from all parts of the market that touches with ICE. And each of them have to come in. And how we say it often in trading is they can't talk their book. So if you're a trader coming in, you often want to be able to go and influence, or you'd like to be able to influence the exchange, influence a contract so that it benefits you and your firm and how you're trading. But all of these players have to come on the cotton committee and they have to work as if they are a neutral party and we've got to find something that works for the whole universe of cotton traders, not just for one company or another company. So it's not just those buying or those selling, it's got to work for everyone. So it's a real testament to those guys who are on our committees, where they come in with a fresh perspective, but they also park at the door all of their feelings, all of their intentions about what happens for them at their company, how they're going to make money. They've got to leave that aside and they've got to do what is the best.
Does that apply, for instance, for premium discounts when it comes to different cotton qualities, etc., depending on what's grown that year?
Correct. And often there's discussion. So if we add that into the exchange, the premium discount and how much it's going to be, a lot of that, there will be a discussion and a very formal discussion. And then if we have to change anything in the rules, it goes to the board, our ICE Futures US board, to get approval. But first, the cotton committee has to agree to it. And it's trying to get a unanimous decision on that. So it's a lot of different back and forth to get every committee members' perspective on how they think that this will be best for the market.
And another example of what the committee is probably talking about, and I'm curious to hear your take on that, is the way that the entire cotton industry is changing at the moment, with the US cotton in particular losing a little bit of its market share to places like Brazil as a huge producer. Is that something that ICE is looking at? I know that you've talked about the world cotton contract before, but some listeners may have forgotten what it was. So what's your latest on
that? Yeah, so it was quite interesting when I was at a cotton conference in early June, and that was one of the things someone had actually told us was, the world has changed since you launched the World Cotton Contract. So just to sort of back up, it was probably about 6 years ago, five, 6 years ago, that we looked at the World Cotton Contract. And that was really trying to understand, should we have more places in the world, have it delivered somewhere so that you have not just the US cotton for delivery. Again, these are all different stakeholders with different perspectives. So we had that 5 years ago, and now we're having people saying, listen, where you were 5 years ago is very different than where you are now. And Camille, like you said, there is more coming out of Brazil. Do you start looking at making this more global? These are, I mean, I guess advantages, disadvantages, these things move slowly, but part of it, it's moving slowly to see how the world progresses. So often it's, okay, let's look at what's happening now. Let's revisit it over our next committee meeting or two or three committee meetings from now, understand how things are changing. But often we have in the committee can be very sort of small things of like interactions between a clearing member and a client, and how, not a specific client, not a specific clearing member, but how the paperwork basically flows between them. Do we want to adjust the paperwork? Because a lot of that stuff is in the rules. So we do talk about bigger issues, but often the cotton committee meetings end up being about much more direct impacts on the exchange and the contract itself. How we try to get perspective of what's happening in the market is going to all these events and speaking to all these players. So we have three or four people within the organization that will go to a number of different events, talk to people, go to the event in Liverpool, for example, the International Cotton Association event in Liverpool, and try to figure out what is happening there. What are they seeing? Do we look at revisiting a world cotton contract? It was a huge amount of work, and some of us think it would be great to do it again. Some of us think, oh my gosh, we've got to do it again.
I think it was about 10 years ago, because it's literally, I think,
was it that long ago? Was it that long? Oh my God, I am dating myself.
My first case was to look at it and try to understand the rule.
Actually, you know, I think you're right, because I remember going to the Malaysian ports, and I think my youngest baby had just been born. So I think she was about, and I took a day trip to Malaysia, and I think she must have about 10 or 11 months old. So I think you're right. It was a long time ago. It was, and I remember some of the exciting things. We went to the Malaysian High Commission as well. And we'd go in and we went into the Malaysian, talked to the Malaysian High Commissioner and requested for changes in regulation in Malaysia. It was really important in trying to understand, do we include Vietnam? And if we include Vietnam, how do we include Vietnam? Do we look at Indonesia? Is that something that's going to work? Why or why not? So it was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, it must have been really interesting to be behind the scenes working on all of that. I know, you know, just having US as the one growth that can be delivered to ICE exchange now is complicated enough. So, you know, having to make all the rules and understand how all of these growths are going to be delivered could not have been an easy task.
No, and doing physical is much more difficult than cash. So how, when we look at futures, we can either do a physical contract, which can take 2 to 5 years to actually develop. Then you can look at a cash settled one. And when we do cash, we usually go to what we call a PRA, or price reporting agency, and they'll be the ones who will determine what the price is, maybe on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. And we just settle off of that PRA. So we do that a lot in oil. So we use a firm called Platts. We do a lot with them. They're called S&P Commodities now, if I've got their new name right. And they will dictate what the price of it's going to be at the end of the month, and we settle off of that. And that's easy to launch. Physical delivery is hard. And what's really, I think, interesting in these soft markets, they're old and they've been around a long time. So when you're looking at these past markets of coffee, sugar, and cotton, they've been around a huge amount of time. I don't think it would work in a cash settled system in the same way. This is what people are incredibly comfortable with. And it's not perfect. Like, delivery can still be challenging, and understanding how it works, or new people coming in, or making sure you have clearing members that can manage the delivery process. It's so much more tangible than some of the other stuff that we do. So that makes it more exciting, I think.
I think this also would be a good time to ask Jen what role ICE plays in the value chain, jumping off of it being a physically settled contract.
Delivered. What do you think? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the biggest things we do, I think, is the technology side of it, and the ability for us to be able to provide a platform that is transparent for people to understand what pricing is going to be. So that's, like I'm saying, the, you know, farmers in Mongolia or anywhere else can look and say, I know exactly what the price of cotton is going to be, or they can be in Australia and see this. And it's completely transparent. And even if they don't get real-time data, they can usually see what we call delayed prices, and within 15 minutes it updates. So they basically know what's happening in the market on a almost instantaneous basis. The other thing we try to do with our company, so ICE has grown a lot. So when I joined, we were just exchanges. We've now gone into data as well, and understanding how data and exchanges link, and clearing how all of this links together. And it's making those connections. So a bit of it for us is, how do you connect people between, like, they got to get the information. How do you give them the best information possible? So yes, it's through the exchange, but it's also providing them other data. So for example, weather data or shipping data. And so that they can go on different platforms that we offer and say, okay, we can look at what's happening in shipping. We can look at what's happening in weather. We can link it to what's happening in the cotton prices. And if you're not just a cotton trader or a cotton merchant, and you might be a hedge fund, for example, then you can look across commodities. You can look at weather patterns across commodities and try to make a determination of where prices are going to go across different commodities. So a lot of it is making connections, so which seems simple. But I think even as when I was a salesperson, it was making the connection. It's either the connection from a client to data, or a client to a clearing member, so a clearing member can give them access to the exchange. Because all clients, they don't come to us. And we used to have the odd person knock on our door and say, I want to trade on ICE. But we have to explain to them, we provide the trading. You have to go to a clearing member. And just like if most people know how to buy stocks and bonds and ETFs, and they go to a broker, it's the same idea. You have to go to a broker or a clearing member to be able to get access to the market. And again, it's making connections. It's making connections on podcasts like this, so that people start to understand, how does the futures work? How does the clearinghouse work? How does the traders work together? How do all these different players in the market, how do they work together? And how do we provide the best platform for people to be able to trade, make their decisions, manage the risk?
Yeah, absolutely. And I imagine, you know, emerging technologies and changes in technologies that we've seen over the last several years have made it a lot easier for other players to come into the market and become active players in the market as well.
Yeah, because I think you've got people who would never have looked at the cotton markets in the same way because they weren't able to get access to what was happening in the physical market or understanding or putting links together. So, and I've heard of things where people will have different types of software, and we don't have this, but they have different types of software where they're pulling up information off of news headlines, which then allows them to trade off of news headlines. And if you didn't have that in the past before, you didn't understand how does the physical interact with this or be able to pull that. If you can't have that, how do you make the trading decisions? So I think we're moving into a different era where people have so much information. How do they take that information and make it manageable and readable for them? So that's one thing that we're and I guess manageable and not readable is not the right word. I guess manageable and accessible so that they can quickly understand what's happening. I was talking with a friend the other day, and part of the things that they're looking at for salespeople, they're trying to look at some type of application which allows them to be able to, you know, type in a search word, and it will pull up all the information off of their intranet, all the information off of news channels, and basically in seconds put together an overview of what's happening. So you could put a client's name or say physical cotton, for example, and everything that's coming from the news will show up in like a three-quarter page document. They can quickly scan it and walk to a client's office or make a business decision. And we're in a place where we never would have expected that you can see that before. I mean, I think dating myself, when I was in university, we were still, I mean, I had to go to the library to use my email address and to send emails because I didn't have access at all. But those are, and now you look where you are and all this information you have, and there's so much coming at us. How do you figure out how to make it accessible and then you can quickly figure out a way to use that to help you manage risk? And that's where we're going.
Yeah, it's to try to give people the pace that. At which it's changing as well. I mean, even just when I started in the industry, we were still using fax to bid on recaps in the US. Yeah. So, yeah.
And we're finally moving away from that. Like, we're at emails, but how do at one point are you able to take all that together and just make it so seamlessly and easy? And I started because our CEO saw a place where in the energy markets, there was too much, it was too analog, it was on the floor. And the idea is you move things from analog to digital. And as you move things over to digital, it makes things easier and more accessible. You're connecting these dots for everyone. So we've done that and brought data into it. And then we're also doing it in the mortgage space as well in the US, where it's very paper-based. How do you take a paper-based system and make it much faster and much more inexpensive for people to be able to close a mortgage? So, yeah. And that's what we did on exchanges. It was closing down floors, pushing it on electronic, and linking everyone together.
No, that's super interesting. And you just talked about university here. I wonder if your university self would have thought that if you fast forward, you are president of ICE Future US, if you even knew what that was at the time. Of course I didn't.
I don't think I ever knew what it was. And I look back on, actually, my dad's very proud of me. So when I was sort of about 15, 16, he started introducing me to women in the finance market because he was in risk management. And he sort of, my mother was a homemaker. She had a degree to be able to teach, but she was mostly at home working at home rather than in the workforce. So he had me meet all these women. And it was a fantastic experience where I'd sit down. And I think a lot of it was just amazed that these women who wear these lovely outfits are buying me lunch, telling me what they do. And I probably understood like 5 or 10% of it. And I remember sometimes just being so enamored by them and thinking, I want to do that. And I don't know if it was that what they did, but I just want to be someone like them. And then trying to sort of, as you change over time, trying to use those people as mentors. I had another strong mentor who was my then father's boss, and he really helped me to understand when you want to find a job, you find a job that makes you happy. You find a job that gives you passion and belief, because I still firmly believe 80% of your job should not feel like work. It should be something you like. And you always dislike 20% of it. I don't think everything's going to be perfect, but how do you find something that makes you happy? And it just, you grow.
We can certainly feel the passion when you share your story, for sure. And you touched on it at the beginning, when after the introduction, and That makes me think of a quote that I think is from Kierkegaard: "Life could only be understood backwards, but must be lived forward." So when you look at your career
that,
from the back, it makes sense up to this point. But when you were into it, probably didn't. So can you share? Because obviously we're organizing this podcast through the Women in Cotton Committee. So if you had a word of advice for women starting in the industry and the use of mentor, as you just said, what would it be?
I've used mentors probably informally, but consciously throughout my whole life. It has always been a way of, and you move from, and I found if I look back, and I've moved from mentor to mentor. So my first mentor that I sort of say was formal was my dad's boss, Len Brennan. And every time I needed some career advice in my early stages, so this is sort of before I was 30, I would ring him and say, this is what's happening in my life. This is what I'm thinking of. What ideas do you have? And then as I moved into the NYMEX, which he actually, at the time when I was moving into the NYMEX, I was moving from the MAS there, I had a job offer at two different banks. And he was really the one that said, you find a job that makes you happy and everything else will come. Do not find a job that's going to make other people happy or impress other people. You do something that makes you happy. And then my then boss at the NYMEX, Tom McMahon, he became my mentor for a number of years as well. He was actually, this is an amazing, he was in the cotton markets, and his father was in the cotton markets from when he was younger. So his father worked on the cotton floor of the New York Cotton Exchange. And I remember Tom taking me to New York City and walking me through downtown New York and saying, this is the Cotton Exchange. This is where I went with my dad in Hanover Square. When they brought it down, my brother and I came here with him, and we took the original cotton bell, the floor bell, that was like a Vanderbilt steam floor engine bell, and they took it. And they brought it home, and he'd walk me down and explain how all of these things had happened in New York City. He had started in the markets because when he was 12, 13, he was running bonds between the Cotton Exchange to Merrill Lynch and Bank of New York Mellon. I think there was a number of different players. And he said, I was 13 taking like $1.5 million check and running it down the street to hand these over. And he said it was absolutely fascinating. But he opened my eyes, and also it's having a mentor that says, you can do this, and gave me some direction, but not a huge, and gave me enough rope that that was fantastic. And then when I moved into ICE, it was finding people in ICE. So I have my colleague, Chris Edmonds, my first boss, David Goon. A lot of them showed me so many different ways of seeing the market and understanding, and just being able to sit down and be open enough to someone to say, how does this work? How is it going to work here? And being able to call someone and just get advice from them and how you're going to work within the organization and with people outside of the organization. And then navigating within your organization, if you do want to move up, how do you move up? So I've had a few people that have rung me and sort of said, we want to look at enhancing our career at ICE. What do we do? And it's trying to sit down with them and say, okay, what do you do now? How do we look at this? And I had a call with someone just 2 days ago about this of, how do we try to get you to where you want to go? Who should you talk to? And to understand that the time frame is probably not 3 months, you're probably looking at 3 to 5 years. And I think there's a lot of patience you need to have with this as well. I love ICE because for me, it's a family. We are focused on team. We are focused on working together. And I've always felt that everybody I work with cares about me, cares about who I am, cares about how, and my family, like they are like my family. Now, and I had dinner with a colleague on Tuesday, and that's what we're talking about. Like internally, some of our best friends are within our company, and they are family for us. And that's what I think makes it such a great company to work for as well.
That's so amazing, Jen. And you know, when we spoke last week, you had spoken a little bit about mentorship, but I really liked the word that you had used. You said throughout your career, you've found champions.
Yeah, you're right.
Each company you've been at and within ICE and that you have tried to be a champion for other people who you work with. And I think it's so powerful and meaningful that you push that forward. And I just, you know, in my career, and I think Camille would say the same, to have mentors and to have champions really is so important. So it's just great to hear you have had that experience and have been able to be a champion for others
as well.
And I
think I'd always tell people that they have to go, they can't wait for it to happen to them. They have to go and search out people that fit for them as well. And not every person's going to fit for them as a mentor. So you have to find someone that works, and you have to try to build that relationship and do that. So I have someone that I speak to, and she's a daughter of a friend now, and she just calls me ad hoc, but it's more like, this is a job I'm looking at. What can you tell me about it? So the last time when she rang me, I actually talked to colleagues internally. We found somebody who worked at the company she wanted to work at. She managed to speak to them. We talked about living situations because she was going to move countries. And it's just so beautiful to see someone that is trying to figure it out and wants to grow. And she can go to her dad, but sometimes it's different going to a family member. And I think also going to a woman. When you're a woman going to a woman, it does help. And it's Absolutely. Trying to show other women that we can have a family, we can work, we can feel successful, we can be very proud of ourselves, and we can help other people. And it's really, I think a big part of it is helping other people grow.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story here and sharing more about ICE Futures. There's a question that we like to ask to our guests, and it is, what's the one thing about Cotton that you think people should know or that you care about?
So the one thing, and I know we had talked a little bit about this earlier, is I think the history of cotton. So what I don't think people understand is that trading in the U.S. and cotton started in 1870 on the New York Cotton Exchange, and that was traders and merchants coming in together. It was just in the aftermath of the Civil War and starting to trade cotton. And that has evolved so much over time. Before ICE had bought it, because I mentioned that there used to be a floor, and some people may have seen the movie Trading Places, which is ages old now, but this sort of idea of the floor and people trading on the floor, and just the characters that you have there. There was one woman who had started on the floor, and I think she was maybe on the first woman on the floor for about 5 or 6 years. Her name was Jewel Weiss, I think, or Weiss was her surname. She was a very strong woman, and I remember meeting her earlier this year, and just, I think, her power and the way all of, was an event that we'd had, but all the people around her respected her for what she did, and she was incredibly strong in a time when you just didn't have women trading at that time on the floor. And she broke those barriers and like, I'm going to do this. I love this. This is going to be what I do. And it's fascinating to see that. And we're lucky things have changed now. And I think in the next 15, 20 years, it's going to be even more amazing to see what changes with women in the workforce.
I can't wait to see
it. Great. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you. Thank you, Katie Camille. This has been wonderful. I've loved having this.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. It really was an honor to have you with us today. Oh, wow. What a great conversation we just had with Jen.
Yeah, she's truly inspiring and so passionate. It transpires in everything she says.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's just had such a long and impressive career. And I loved that you brought up that quote, Cam, about, you know, living your life forward. It only really makes sense when you look back at it.
Yeah, it does. There's a, you know, when you're at a standing point or a crossing point, you just don't really know what to do. But then when you look behind, it all makes sense. So that was very inspiring. So interesting as well to better understand the role of ICE in the industry. I mean, there's such a misconception that people can just log onto that platform and just buy and sell, but we have no idea who's behind it. And I was particularly interested in the fact and the work that is being done behind the scene to stay relevant, to stay in touch with the physical market and work with all stakeholders.
Jen touched on it too, that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, the cotton market was completely different with who would have been engaged on the exchange and who would have been participating in the market. But because of these emerging technologies and things that are changing, it's so much easier to get access to information today. It's just completely changed the dynamic of how the industry works.
Yeah, and in our journey to find out more about the cotton value chain in general and shed some light on things, I think it'll be super interesting to bounce back on some of the points that she brought up with a merchant when we're trying to better understand the role of the merchant in the cotton value chain. And yeah, we are not going to reveal our star guest for that episode yet, but that should be super interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait to kind of compare that episode with this episode and to see the conversations we can have, because, you know, we're talking about how dynamic and different the industry has become. And to learn from a merchant exactly what we were talking about with Jen about, you know, the idea of a world cotton contract and what is a merchant's perception of that and what value would it bring to the industry and what would it change?
We'll be sure to ask that question.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Thing About Cotton. We hope you enjoyed our conversation with Jennifer Ilkew. Catch us next time when we interview a cotton merchant to continue on this conversation about the liquidity that ICE futures and cotton merchants add to the value chain. If you want to learn more about today's episode or have other questions about the cotton value chain, feel free to email us at podcast@ica-ltd.org. Don't forget to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google, and follow the Women in Cotton group on LinkedIn and Facebook to find out more about our upcoming podcast episodes, events, and engage with men and women in the industry. Special thanks to the International Cotton Association for giving us this platform to deliver the podcasts.